Hello everybody, my name's Dougie and you're listening to the Made in Scotland 80s podcast. This is part two of the Paul McGeoghegan story and this episode is all about love and money. Enjoy. I move on from Friends Again to Love and Money.
Yeah.
So when Friends Again, we had that one album.
Yeah.
And then did we decide?
Well, Friends Again, it was interesting. We were frustrated.
Right.
Because the record company kept on putting the release date for the album back because we didn't have a hit. That's how things kind of worked.
Yep.
We wanted you to break into a single and then get the album out. But we were touring all the time. You know, we'd done tons and tons of shows. We toured with the Bluebells a few times and all that. So we were playing all the time and building the kind of audience live. And so had some great shows and real good fun, you know. But the album kept getting put back, which was frustrating for the band. And I think partly we ran out of steam, you know, by the time. And there was a few changes in. You know, a few things maybe going on in the band that were just like frustrating. And then we knew James wanted to kind of do more of his own thing as well. He'd started writing more and, you know, he'd written South of Love. And yeah, so I think James had a focus on doing his own thing as well.
Suppose we have a wee bit of that impatience of youth as well.
But the album was just sitting, you know, so it was quite frustrating because you'd done it. And so I think that was part of it, you know. And that was interesting as well because we'd been trying to get on the Tube for ages and we just got on the week we split up.
Right.
We got told we were going to be on it. And
Did you just play the Tube?
We should have just played it, you know.
Aye.
But we didn't, so.
Yeah. So there'd have been footage of that kicking about now.
Aye. But there you go.
Aye. So then Love and Money came
about. Then Love and Money, yeah. So Friends Again split up and Love and Money started the month after. That was kind of quite quick, yeah. And we were still all signed to Phonogram, so they had the first option on it. So we kind of went straight into a recording deal with that.
Right, okay.
As well, you know. So we went to Park Lane Studios in Glasgow, and we did four songs. He says.
Oh, there's a tape.
18th to the 22nd of December, 1984.
That's
it. We did
that's eight gold.
Songs.
Eight songs he's done. Oh, wow.
So that was our first demo. And then we did another demo at Park Lane straight after that with another four songs that went on the first album, Candy Bar Express.
So now I'm holding the actual demo.
Yeah.
Cassette form.
Aye.
Wow, that's amazing.
So, yeah, so then and that had the second set had, what's this has got? Did any of these make on it? The album? Pain Is a Gun made the album.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next one we did, about a month after, we did You're Beautiful, Candy Bar Express, Love and Money, Cheeseburger, and they all went on. We re-recorded them, but those songs went on the album.
Do you know, I just played that, I was telling you, that album I picked up yesterday at the A Hollow Wall record shop in Straven. And that's a cracking album.
It's an album I haven't listened to. I like some of the songs.
Yeah,
I particularly
aye.
Like the record, if you know what I mean.
Right.
So it's one of those things. But yeah, it is what it is. Mm-hmm. We recorded it early and there's a couple of good things on it.
Get your hankies out. If I can hold you, I'd never let you go. This drunken night is passing like sorrow's bride. It's passing so slow, sit, keep on falling till I fall onto my feet.
Yeah, you've hit the ground running. There's a few things. So we did the demos and stuff, and it was going to be a while before that we could get to do the album. But then James had two kind of ideas going. We had one thing, and then the candy bar and all that was another thing.
Yep.
But the record company, once they heard that, they moved things to get us in the studio because they thought they could have a hit with that. So
the
so
Candy Bar Express.
Forward. Aye. So, yeah. Yep. So that helped in a timescale sense. But so that would have been, that came out in 85, I think. No, did it? 86, that's what it would be, yeah. So we'd be doing it in 85. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'd be 23, James would be 20, you know. So we were still, even though we'd been in Friends again, we were still quite young when we started Loving Money, you know. So I'm off and running again.
Aye, off and running again. And you know, as you say, there's some really, really great songs on that one. I'm reading here that you supported U2 at Murrayfield as well.
We did.
I think I was at that gig.
Yeah, God, that was, yeah, we did. So there was it was us.
The Big Dish.
Can't remember Big Dish doing it, but Run Rig.
Run Rig done it.
Run Rig, I remember Run Rig. But I remember doing the show. I've got a photograph. In fact, there's a photograph on my Facebook page of us doing that show, taken from behind us, looking out in the audience. There's a lot of people with the big Love Money t-shirts. We used to have a big red Love Money, and they stand out in the audience. It looks quite good. Looks like our gig, of course it's not. But
I'm sure, Paul, that was my first kind of stadium gig.
Ah, right.
That
was amazing watching you too, if nothing else. But it was quite an experience walking on that stage. It was quite terrifying, if I remember rightly. But yeah, so that was quite early in the band's career.
Yeah, well, definitely. I mean, it's first album, isn't it? It's this and that. And then, you know,
we had toured and stuff, so
you knew what to expect.
By that time, we'd streamlined down to a 6-piece, I think, at that point, when we first were gigging. It was like a 13-piece band, brass, 3 backing vocalists, and all that. Like, early Love Money shows were huge. And then I think we saw how much it was costing.
Did you just hire a big bus?
I can't remember.
Not everybody make their own way.
But no, we did quite a few shows like that with horn section, backing vocalists.
Wow.
And all that, yeah. And it was a kind of there was a wee bit of not a reaction against Friends Again, as in we didn't like what we'd done, but we wanted there to be a distinct, and James wanted there to be a distinct difference in our first show from Friends Again.
Yep.
Because it was that kind of thing, you know, Glasgow audience can be tough, as you know, can be great, but can be tough. Mm. And people had already made their mind up that Friends Again, Love Money, were going to just be another Friends Again. So it was that kind of thing. It's a kind of our first gig, as I say, horn section, backing vocalists, Candy Bar Express, hard hitting, very different from what Friends Again was.
Yep.
And there was part of a statement in that to see what's a different thing.
Take a ride on the sugar train. 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 Get up, get dressed, have nothing to impress. Everybody make a chain. This train is the cheapest and the best. Why, it's better than real under those wheels, north, south, east, and west. You are the station on the Candy Bar Express. Take a ride on the sugar train. 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 Sin City is pretty, and the dirt looks just like money. Well, everything's cool, cause it's a loving school, and the tools are milk and honey. Don't be deceived, you better believe that sugar is the best. You are the station on the Candy Bar Express. And there's sugar to sell, money to buy, got heaven and hell in a single life. Get wise, capitalize, get fed on your hands, have an alibi. Get fed on your hands, have an alibi.
good cow. You'll never know what you missed. Everybody say yeah, say thanks. If songs like this exist, be a junkie for love, be a sucker for success. You are the station on the Candy Bar Express. Take a ride on the sugar train. 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 Be a junkie for love. Be a sucker for success. Be a junkie for love. Be a sucker for success. Be a junkie for love. Be a sucker for success. Be a junkie for love. On the Candy Bar Express.
Well, that's it. You need to do that, don't you? You
know? And I think James did the same with his solo career when Love and Money split up. You know, he worked hard to be able to do his own shows and not just play Love and Money songs and stuff. And that's a hard thing to do, and I think he did that very successfully.
And I suppose, as an artist, that's a hard thing to try and change.
Because, you know, you have expectations of the audience, and you can just... I'm not pander's too strong a word, but you know, you can just play to that.
Yep.
James wanted to develop his own solo career, and he has done very well. It takes work to do that, you know.
That must be a tough thing to do, and maybe sometimes feel a bit, this is what I do, this is what I do now. And
I think it's
a two-edged sword as well, isn't it? You appreciate
a big hit for some artists can be an albatross, you know.
Aye, it can.
So we have managed to avoided that albatross.
maybe not so much, because then when your next album comes out in 1988, Strange Kind of Love, you know, that's
35 years in next year, is it? Yeah, it will be.
It will be, aye. So that came out in 88. I was 18 at the time. Yeah. And I was like...
I'd be 26, so... I was 25 when I was recording in 87. So, yeah. I mean, again, you know, when you think of it, it's still quite young.
Yeah. So from, for you, touring from All You Need Is Love and Money from 86.
Yeah, because we did a lot of touring. We did.
Were you writing on the road?
Well, again, James. So James wrote Strange Kind of Love. So I guess he would be. I mean, because we toured with B.B. King, we toured with Simply Red. All sorts of
huge artists. I mean, America, Japan, you were everywhere.
And so we did a lot of live work, but we used to demo extensively. So James must have been writing, because we then went into Savar for like 6 weeks and demoed. I mean, the demos were like a record. It wasn't like, you know, everything was there.
Right.
So like Strange Kind of Love was demoed like Strange Kind of Love.
She's like a mermaid, locked in the dungeon of a sunken ship. She thinks she's happy, though she's been drawn in by shallow things. She closes her eyes, and he keeps all the treasure he finds. While in the back of my a strange kind of love, a strange kind of love, it's a strange kind of love, keeps me hanging on. She said built on his promises and dreams.
my story for the whole world to see. In lines beneath my eyes, she bathes me with pity. I could never be your friend if I could never be your king. I'm wild.
So do you have masters of them?
Yeah, we've got.
You keep them hidden away.
So some of that did come out. There was a Love and Money, Strange Kind of Love reissue.
Yeah.
And I would like to say it was a couple of years ago, but it's not. It's most likely closer to 12 years ago. Cherry Red. And there was some of the original versions on that.
Right.
So I put that together. I keep everything. So
yep.
I'm one of these kind of people that have got everything. So.
Yeah. I mean, you're credited with writing
Avalanche.
Aye.
So that came about. It's a piano. It was a piano thing. I was playing it. Remember it very well in the venue in Edinburgh. And James said, "Oh, what's that you're playing?" I said, "No, it's just an idea." And he then wrote the song around that piano riff. So that's how James and I would work something. You know, I'd play him something. And if he liked it, he would develop it. If he didn't, he wouldn't. So
would it be yourself and James?
Yeah, so just
bouncing about ideas.
Way back, You're Beautiful, I'd written the piano up in the outhouse, just round the corner from
right.
And gave it to James, and he did the melody.
Do you have any ideas of the melody?
Not for those songs. Although, Avalanche, the vocal melody is the piano melody in the chorus, so he must have just taken that as an idea and developed that.
Just a little something everybody else seemed to have. A cushion of love to help me take the strain. I hope it rains the day I die. It's hard to explain. I was told the streets were paved with gold. I've been bought and sold on a millionaire's plan. I don't know how long I can just keep holding on, looking for a miracle, waiting for a last chance. I'm praying for an avalanche. I'm praying for an avalanche. Some people just ignore what they don't understand. With the checkbooks in the hands. When we have a reason, we don't need an axe to grind. I don't have the cash, I don't have the time. I pray fate will be kind. I was told the streets were paved with gold. Bought and sold on a millionaire's price. I don't know how long
But James was such, I was saying this to Bobby Bluebell the other day, you know, James was such a prolific writer, and of course still is, and also a brilliant writer. So there's something, it depends on your viewpoint, and we were discussing, as I say, Bobby and I were discussing that the other day. So, you know, some bands fight over the financial element of that, because the songwriter's the one that's going to make the money, obviously, yep, if it's successful. But there is a balance of, are you just putting things into the pot to get a writing credit, whereas loving money, I think the focus of the writing was part of the strength of the band, you know, rather than diluting that by us trying to force other songs in, then having James's work was strong. Also, James would write 30 songs to Bobby and I's too, do you know what I mean? So,
right, okay.
So, you know, so trying to get a song on the Love and Money album wasn't, it wasn't easy, and it wasn't
when
James's
you weigh up the percentages.
Fault, do you know what I mean? He would write 30 good songs and we'd write two.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So, you know, you're never going to...
So did Bobby take part in the writing process as well?
Well, Bobby and him would write stuff as well. So
right.
I think Bobby's credited... Oh, I'm trying to remember. Jocelyn Square is a co-write Bobby and James. And there's another couple that didn't make the record as well. So we'd put things forward, and if James thought he could do something with them, he would. He wasn't kind of not as my, I'm doing it all, you can't put something in. But as I say, he was just... I never saw myself as I'm not a songwriter, you know.
Yeah. Did you get more into the engineering production side of things then?
It's, you know, have this conversation with my kids. I've got four children, and, you know, Josh is 30 and Niall's just turned 28. And Niall thinks, you know, recordings should be free, you know. And it's,
right.
We have discussions around that kind of thing. But we were very fortunate, I think, when we made those records that, you know, people are very quick to criticise the music industry. And there's a lot of reasons to criticise the music industry of the 80s. But one of the things that afforded us was to get up out of bed as a musician.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have to work in a cafe. We didn't have to have three jobs or do anything else. That was our job. You know, you got up and you did what you did. And sometimes you did nothing, which is terrible. But nevertheless, that was a hugely fortunate position to be in, you know.
Yeah.
So those record companies had a ridiculous amount of money, but they chose to spend some of that on us, and that developed our career. So gave James the opportunity to write, it gave me the opportunity to do it. So I can't look back on that and say, you know, I criticise everything about major companies, because it gave us that a 10-year.
And is that a hard thing to digest?
No, I mean, it was... We were very fortunate also that the music industry was slightly smaller in a sense. And I'm not saying that's a good thing or bad, it's just an observation, you know. We're sitting in my studio just now, and all this stuff allows me to make records, but you could make a record in your house without any of this stuff, just with Logic, you know. And that's a fantastic opportunity for artists. The negative side of that opportunity is maybe it's harder to break out, because there's so many artists.
Yep.
So it's, you know, there's pluses and negatives to it all. Uh-huh. The best thing is it allows everyone to have a voice, I think. So if someone's got something to say musically, fantastic, you can do that. It was slightly different. You didn't have a studio like this in the 80s unless you were, you know, Dave Gilmour or someone. The equipment was so expensive. And maybe more difficult to use, you know. You had to learn more. There was far more of a technical skill required, like to operate a tape machine like that one over there. You had to learn that.
Yeah.
Whereas you can teach yourself Logic or Pro Tools.
You know, because your tape machine is quarter inch.
And all that stuff. So there was maintenance involved that isn't now, you know. So there was a lot of technical stuff you had to do. So to have a studio like this, you just couldn't have done it unless you were a huge artist, you know. So that whole side's a great change for people to record, but, you know, there's not many artists that will get a record contract or a situation that will let them just do that art form.
Yeah.
You know, I was reading something in the paper the other day, and it was like 0.0034 pence of a play for Spotify, you know. With the guy that owns it, 48 million bucks, yeah, you know.
And over Nick and buy back catalogs.
So it's very difficult. So that, if nothing else, what that did was allow you to hone your craft if you wanted to do that. It would allow you to do nothing if you wanted to do that also, but it would give you time to go in the studio or write or whatever. We did that. A lot of money spent, you know, days in the studios crafting stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and I think any artist will say that. You know, you only get out what you put in, you know. It's just you have to work at something. We just wanted to make good records.
And they've stood the test of time, you know, and they're really, really...
It is a combination of luck and work and, you know, James's talent and all that as well. And James and Bobby were amazing musicians, you know, really. James had to persuade Bobby to join Love and Money because he'd been in so many bands that he was just thinking, I'm going to be an engineer and stop doing this. But James persuaded him.
Was Bobby in the original formation of Primal Scream?
No, he engineered
a
Primal Scream early recording at Park Lane. So Bobby had become an engineer at Park Lane.
Ah, right.
Because he was into production and all that as well.
So
he did, I think he did Primal Scream, I think. A few others. Yeah, he did a few things, you know. But yeah, he was a very talented musician. But James had to kind of say, look, this band's going to be huge.
Come and join us. And you're local as well. Did you ever have any... other guys wanting to join the band when they seen Love and Money, the Strange Kind of Love time?
I mean, we also had someone who said he was in the band that wasn't.
That wasn't me.
There's a guy in Glasgow that used to say he was in the band.
Like, right.
He used it up.
And is he well known? Was it Graham Skinner?
No, he wasn't a friend.
Just a guy. I wonder if it's worked. You know,
very strange thing to do. But no, yeah, I mean, I'm sure there was. And, you know, we had a couple of guitarists that used to tour with us as well. John Palmer, still a friend. Adrian and I are going out for dinner with him, hopefully over the next few weeks. Mm-hmm. John toured with us for a long time, and then Douglas took over when John was doing his own band.
Right.
A band called The Right Stuff. And that's when Douglas joined us to tour on the Strange Kind of Love tour. We'd already done the album.
Yep.
And then Douglas joined the band to tour as Davey Watson did on drums because Stuart left before we recorded the album. So hence why Jeff Picaro did the drums on that. Gary got him to do it. And then Douglas joined to tour the Strange Kind of Love album, then stayed with the band after that.
Recording Strange Kind of Love.
Yep.
And it was going into production, and it was Gary Katz who'd done your production. Did you notice a difference in level of production?
Well, or? There was a difference in a lot of things. So recording the first album, it was slightly more disjointed. James was I don't know what it was, but he had something wrong with his side, and he couldn't sit very long when he was playing. So he was off a few times.
Yep.
I don't know. It was a different thing. There was different producers on the first album, so that also made it slightly disjointed. And the songs themselves, so you kind of get your ballads and you've got these big kind of guitar-based things. So desperate's maybe strong, but, you know, it's not so joined together. It's not a complete record in the sense. And although we'd recorded as friends again stuff before, and Tom Dowd produced it. It was amazing, but it's just not quite there. For me.
So who picks the producer? Is it
record company suggestions? Right. Both Andy Taylor and Tom Dowd, but really good suggestions as well. I mean, Tom, he'd worked on everything, you know, Aretha Franklin, Eric Clapton, blah blah blah. You know, amazing. And it was a good learning experience. The record's not as good as it could be, is what, you know, my own opinion. Andy Taylor was an amazing producer. You know, he was a hard person to work with because just who he was, you know, where he was theme-wise and what went with that.
Uh-huh.
You know, and there was some difficulties around that. But looking back on it, he really knew what he was doing. He didn't like the mixes that came out. He was dissatisfied it wasn't his mixes, someone else did it. But he was, I mean, it was hard to get him in the studio, you know. You'd go in the studio, he'd get bored really easy. So right. We went to LA to do the track called Cheeseburger. And we were in for a couple of hours. He says, well, do you guys want to go to Disneyland? And we're like, no, we want to record a record. So that was tough. It took us 2 weeks to do a single because we couldn't get him in the studio. He was bored all the time.
Right.
So, but he knew how to make a rock record, Andy Taylor, really did. I think he'd come off the back of doing the Power Station.
Yeah, because they'd done a little split from Duran Duran.
I mean, he was talented, but just difficult.
And I suppose as a producer, that's probably the one thing you can't be.
Yeah, I think it's just because he was in Duran Duran, and that was a difficult thing.
Yeah,
you know, it was so huge. You know, it was just it wasn't reality.
Sure, there'd be a lot.
You know, it just wasn't reality.
No.
Let's leave it. So the second album, Strange Kind of Love, was different because we had demoed everything up to, I would say, album quality.
Yep.
You know, you could have released it. It's not, it wouldn't have been as good as production as the record ended up being, of course. And again, that was David Bates, head of A&R at Phonogram, that said you should work with Gary Capps.
Right.
And who's going to say
no?
If you know who Steely Dan are, then you're going to say yes to that.
So
James flew over and met Gary and had a chat and all that. And then, so the initial idea was for him to come here, but he wouldn't come to Britain because there was no sports. So we went to America, and that was. I mean, I most likely had the best experience. I think Bobby was married, so it was a long time to be away from home.
Yeah,
James was a singer, so he had to do a lot more work.
So had you done your part?
I think my job was the easiest, sense. But no, I had a really good time. Also, you know, as a 25-year-old. Living in Manhattan or living in America for nearly a year at someone else's expense is not.
It's not even knocked back, Paul.
Sorry.
You must wake up.
Our friends
and go.
Were there as well for quite a bit of time. Graham and the guys from Hipsway, they were living in one apartment. We were living in another for a couple of months. And so, you know,
so
we
must have had some
and
wild nights.
Bobby
out.
Henry was over producing Shine, we did. And. My now brother-in-law, Mark, was managing them. He was there. So there was quite a wee community at points. A lot of time there wasn't, but you know. But it was a great time to be in Manhattan because Manhattan's a brilliant city, I think. At the moment, it's quite gentrified.
Yeah, yeah.
Everyone's moved out because no one can afford to live there,
you
know. So at that point, they started cleaning up the city, so it wasn't as dangerous.
Right.
But it was just on that brink of still being interesting enough.
You know,
there was art houses, there was studios, there was, you'd go bowling, you'd meet someone that was having a party in a photography studio, whatever.
Right.
There was stuff happening, you know. It was still at street level. That's gone, you know.
So it's still
a fantastic city, but it's a different city from what it
was. So during that time, you were over there for the year making that, and all your parts were done, and you had the guys from Hipsway were over. Out of all these people, who was living the life of the rock star, shall we say?
I don't know.
I think we were working.
I mean, Love and Money, you know, the album was taking a long time, so it got to a point we'd be in the studio 6 days a week.
Right.
You know, but we were still out.
You're not going to spill any beans, you know. What happened in Manhattan?
It was a fun time, you know. We worked hard, but we also had a lot of good parties and a lot of good. I mean, one of the things that I remember is like we were staying in the Mayflower Hotel. So there's a hotel in London called the Columbia, which is run down.
Right.
It's all the bands always stayed there. Uh-huh. So the Mayfair's equivalent. It's gone now, but it looked over Manhattan, over Central Park. And all the artists in town would stay there. But I went in one night and I thought, that looks like Bjork and that looks like Bowie and that looks like. Tom Waits was playing on Broadway, and they were all going to see Tom Waits. So I ran upstairs and phoned the record company. Says, "Can we go?" And they got us in. So you two were arriving in a limo. Bowie was walking. You know, it's just like, and then us. But you know, so things like that were just happening all.
That's living the life.
So it was an amazing show. I mean, Tom Waits was he was doing Frank's Wild Years. It was absolutely brilliant. so amazing. And so there was lots of great things. One of my favourite stories is, it's a long story, so I'll cut it short. Adrian and I were meant to be going out for dinner. My now wife, Adrian, my girlfriend at the time, had come over. And it was the night before she went home. We went to a restaurant, couldn't get in, went to another restaurant, an Italian restaurant, and round about 45th Street. And we went in, and it was, so this would be, I'm thinking, August.
Right.
But it was decorated as it's Christmas.
Right.
Kind of weird. There was no one in, and the guy came out and said, oh, we were just about to close, but come in anyway, so we came in. So then the chef came and sat with us for a few drinks and all that. Made us something, came sat with us and all that. But it was done as Christmas because Sinatra had gone for dinner in like 1968 or something into this restaurant. So they just didn't change it. So they just left it decorated the way it had been the days that Sinatra went in.
Wow,
it was
amazing.
Just these two old Italian guys that owned it. It was brilliant. So what an entertaining night. Us two and the guys that worked in the place. It was brilliant. Yeah.
That's the one. You'll never forget that.
No, I'll never forget that. So there's a few stories like that. Yeah.
Aye. Wow, that was the time. Yeah.
But I want, you know, so we'd go to the, we'd meet Hipsway and all that, and he'd be in the studio and we'd do it. And James had already sang on the first Hipsway album, you know, quite. There's a lot of people that get Love and Money and Hipsway confused.
Yeah.
And James's voice is quite prominent on Ask the Lord. I mean, it's like really up there at the beginning. And stuff.
Aye.
So, you know, so we knew them. We'd known them for years and years, you know. I think Graham spoke, when he spoke to you, he talked about Friends Again going into the Rock Garden.
Yep.
We all used to hang out there and, you know, play your demos in the, at the bar.
Aye. You're on the journey together.
Yeah, exactly.
So after Strange Kind of Love, I'm reading here The Mother's Boy. Did that?
Yes, yeah, so
come
that was
about
a title James had, which I suppose it became Dogs in the Traffic, essentially.
Yep.
Dogs in the Traffic was a difficult record to make in the sense that the record company were hearing another Strange Kind of Love.
Right.
And the band weren't. And essentially, James, as a writer as well, certainly wasn't. He wanted to do something, you know, different. So.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a wee bit of a kind of stalemate, maybe for want of a better expression, but they wanted, you know, it's like they've built up, built on this, and they want it to be the same, and Dogs in the Traffic wasn't going to be the same. So they put us through a long demo process, so James would be writing, they'd not the songs back, but they didn't, that's not what they wanted of it, so it took a long time.
Oh, shit. like the countryside that's rained. When love turns to dust, leaves the splinters of your trust forgiven. My forgiver, shine on, shine on in the beauty of the storm I weather. Oh, shine on, shine on in the beauty of the storm. Winter, winter, winter.
Producer, we worked in Savar in Glasgow, and the record company sacked the producer, not us, Tony Phillips, who was great, and then they brought in another producer, Steve Nye, who was also brilliant, and I was quite interested in that. Tony Phillips had worked with Trevor Horn, Steve Nye had worked with, he was in a band with the Penguin Cafe Orchestra and Eno and stuff like that.
Right, right.
He'd mixed the Last Emperor soundtrack. I was a big Sakamoto fan.
Aye.
He'd mixed Tin Drum of Japan. So, I mean, he was right.
Yeah,
he was a producer. Very good. So they suggested him, so we went with that. But it took us a long time to get to that stage.
Right.
And then it was kind of weird because the first couple of days, we were down in Chipping Norton in Oxford. It's a great studio. It wasn't a great place to be because you were saying in your situation earlier on, the people weren't welcoming.
Yeah.
And they especially weren't particularly welcoming to Scots.
Right.
And they certainly weren't welcoming to anyone that had, that you know, a certain ethnic background. They were very separatist,
right.
Let's say. So
okay,
it wasn't
right.
A great place to be culturally. But the studio was nice. But so we went there. And we did a few days, and Steve and I didn't say a word.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he just didn't talk. It's weird.
Aye.
And I think it was maybe day four, and I said to James, if this guy doesn't talk, I'm off.
Aye.
I'm not spending 6 weeks.
No.
He's here doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And James was of the same opinion. So we went for a game of pool and a pint with him and had a chat. And what it was the record company was like that. On his back.
Right.
We want this. And he was stuck. He didn't know how to deal with it.
Yeah.
He hadn't been. So there was us wanting one thing, the record company.
And he's stuck in the middle.
So we said to him, well, the simple solution is you're with us making the record, so we'll make the record we want.
Thank you.
So once we got that out of the way, it was really, he was great to work with. I mean, right. He was very inventive, very encouraging, supportive of, you know, James's writing. And he was a really good guy to work mm-hmm. with, and a great musician himself. And I mean, he'd worked on Roxy albums and stuff way back, you know.
Yep.
And, you know, he'd do unusual techniques and try stuff. He wouldn't be afraid to experiment and all that. That's... So you asked a question about, you know, being interested in electronics and production, and then I didn't follow that. I became a musician, I suppose, a touring yep. and recording musician. But when it came to that record, that's when I was had become interested in technology right. and production. So Strange Kind of Love, I kind of got into learning then, and I was really interested in learning stuff from Steve Nye, but I didn't do any of that. I just was interested in mm-hmm. the techniques and stuff like that.
We're still using tape.
Strange Kind of Love was done on a digital 3M machine, which is a tape-based machine, yeah. but it was a tape machine that was Nightfly. It was 32 tracks.
32.
It was a machine that Nightfly had been recorded on, Donald Fagan. So right. they owned it. So it was an amazing system. And then we went back to analog tape for the third album.
I was listening to a podcast with Hugh Padgingham.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And he was talking about going from 8-track to 16 yeah. to 24. Yeah. And then I think he worked with Trevor Horn back in the early days.
He did. Yeah.
And then he had said, you know, we took the last track from that to make it a 48.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And the whole process of production is fascinating for me. And, you know,
We used to do that all the time, lock two machines together. So right. Two 24 machines together. To
and even to get a crossfade between tracks. Yeah. Must have been so difficult.
Oh yeah, you had to cut the tape.
Aye. Right?
And that's where the term crossfade comes from, because you do a razor blade cut that way and that way.
Right.
And join them together, so it's a crossfade. So that's where that term comes
and
from.
And now we've got the technology or trying to reverse a part of the track.
Yeah, we used to take the tape off and turn it over.
Aye. Do you still do any of that on any of your stuff? Or
well, I do it with modern technology rather than doing it with tape. I mean, I still use tape occasionally, but I still use those ideas and techniques, just in a different way.
In a different
I've been
way.
Using Pro Tools now 25 years or something.
Right.
So I got into that really early on. My friend Eric and Scott Campbell, they started a company called MediaSpec, and I did the training for them on Pro Tools for the BBC engineers, because they knew I was kind of technically savvy. So they lent me a machine. I couldn't afford to buy one then. You know, it was really expensive.
Right.
So that gave me the in to use this technology really, really early on before anyone else really.
So you know every back door in Pro Tools.
Yeah, so Savar had a system in Glasgow, but they're the only studio that it did, and BBC were investing, and so it got me a system that I could. So I for me, the technology that we have now is the technology I would always have liked to have had, you know.
Yeah.
There's things that are great about tape, but for me, a system like Pro Tools or Logic, whatever, it's just another instrument. It's just an extension of, you know. So it's for, when I got Pro Tools, I was like, wow, this is amazing.
Aye, you can do so much.
Although the first system, you could only do 16 tracks and one reverb, but never
a He's played the big day at Glasgow Green, is that
we
right?
We did. In fact, we were talking about that the other day, and the reason I was talking about it the other day is my wife has been listening to a podcast about Tea in the Park, which is brilliant. It's only 4 episodes, 15 minutes.
All right.
And Stuart Klumpus was on talking. Stuart came to visit me about 6 weeks ago. So Stuart used to manage Love and Money and then started Tea in the Park.
Right.
So he lives in New Zealand now. Had come back to visit his kids and couldn't get back in the country because COVID. So he's been over here for he popped by. I hadn't seen him for years, so he popped by to have a chat. And we were talking about the big day because again, it was him that was behind that.
Do you think we'll ever see anything like that again?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it was quite special that it was. I mean, we played George Square. Deacon Plough played the Green down in huge, and you know, I think. Big Country were on.
The Country were on, the River Detectors were on. And
it was brilliant, it was free as well.
It was, aye.
Yeah, it was, so.
One of my memorable footages from it is Michael Stipe doing John Prine's song.
Oh, wow, right.
With Billy Bragg.
I don't think I've seen that. There is a bit of footage of us kicking about YouTube.
Going to be playing some Unity on it that the Rottweilers from a record company won't let you hear. It's called No Chicane.
The fire in your eyes is not for me anymore. The fire in your eyes is not for me. Did you dream your escape? What's been kindled in my place? You can't hide a thing. Your eyes hold no chicane. I was there in the folds of your dress, brushing against your lips. First it had an acid stain, then it numbed me like cocaine. It's just one of those things. Fear gives you wings and takes you places you don't want to go. Tears and things you don't know. Oh Lord, my pride is looser to me. My dreams, my desires are useless to me.
now it hurts me when you laugh. It hurts me when you smile. Take my hand, my archangel. Lead me down the crooked mile. To survive, you got to have something to say. Maybe dream of somebody.
So that was around about Dogs in the Traffic when that came out, because if you, the big day was 1990 and Dogs in the Traffic came out in 91.
What was it, 91? No, it must have been later. Oh, Dogs in the Traffic.
Dogs in the Traffic, right, was 91. Be,
So keep looking for the light. It's on keep Little on. Death. It didn't make Dogs in the Traffic.
Right. Yeah. Right.
So, yeah, but that was good fun doing that show, as far as I remember. I do remember going down to see Deacon Blue. And I also remember meeting my friend Dwayne, and we'd had a few beers and we were singing True all the way up the road for some reason. But watching Deacon Blue and thinking, wow. Because, you know, I'm friendly with Jim. I work with Jim.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've worked with Ricky. I've co-produced an album with Ricky. But I never really knew Deacon Blue's stuff. And, you know, I think when you're in a band, you're too busy concentrating your own thing.
Yeah.
But I remember watching them and thinking, I can understand why they are huge. Because Ricky can take it to a stadium kind of level. And that's the first time I'd seen them do that. I thought, all right, okay, I kind of get that.
Yeah.
It's a different thing, you know, playing at that kind of,
right,
to that kind of size of show.
So as a musician, if you go from a crowd, let's say 4,000 or 5,000, to a stadium size.
I think it's a different thing. I mean, as I say, I mean, we never got to, you know, Love and Money split up before we were doing that kind of thing anyway, but it was just interesting seeing that. You could see that Deacon Blue were going to go on and do that kind of thing. You could see that. And as I say, not every band can.
Yeah.
Not every band wants to either, but, you know.
I noticed that Springsteen, he's just announced.
I know, I'm Murrayfield. Yeah.
Are you going?
Well, I'm hopefully going. One of my colleagues, I went to see him last time he was here. A friend got me a ticket, and then one of the guys I'm going out with tonight, who's a colleague, was side stage.
What was he?
I was like to him, "Where did you get?" And he said, "Oh, Little Stephen, we broadcast his show." And he phoned and said, "Did anyone want to go?"
Oh.
I was like, "And
did you forget about me?"
So tonight I'm going to say, "See when Little Stephen phones you this."
Yeah. Get me a plus one.
I mean, I've always liked Springsteen. You know, I stopped buying his records at one point. I kind of buy them again now when I was in Friends Again. Friends Again, so their album. We were doing an interview. Andrea Miller did the interview. And she said, "Oh, it really reminds me of Springsteen. Friends Again."
Right.
And I was like, "Who's Springsteen?"
Aye.
And she says, "Oh, the piano's really like Springsteen, the vocal reminds me a bit." So I went and I bought a Springsteen record, and I was brilliant. And I got really into Springsteen. I really loved, not that I could play like Roy Brittan, but I really loved his playing and stuff. And so I became a bit of a Springsteen fan. There's another Manhattan story for you. Told you we went to that restaurant, and so Tunnel of Love had just come out,
right?
7.
87, yeah, bye.
And I went to Tower Records the day it came out and bought it, and I loved that record. Right? And a couple of nights later, so I had tickets to go and see U2 at Madison Square Gardens. But the Love and Money album was not, we were behind schedule.
Right.
So I couldn't go, and I said to Adrian, "Do you want to take your cousin?" So she went to the show and said it was amazing. And then a couple of days later, Little Stephen was playing in the Village. I've forgotten the name of the venue, but it held about 400 folk.
Mm.
And I said to her, "Oh, I want to go to this." And she said, "Is that the guy that was supporting you too? He was wearing spandex, I think." "Nah, I think it was." She said, "I'm not going to that. He was rubbish."
Right.
I was like, "No, I'm not going." So we didn't go. It was the Ritz, I remember now.
Right.
Next day in the Village paper, Little Stephen comes on to an audience of 300. Song 4, Springsteen comes on and stays on for the whole set. 1987. Yeah. Tunnel of Love had
Tunnel
just come
love.
Out.
Pretty
Springsteen
much
wasn't playing to less than 250,000 people.
Aye.
And he was in a club with 300 folk, him and little Stephen.
Up and close and personal.
Won for a couple of hours.
Because that's what it does, isn't it?
In the Ritz in Manhattan in 90.
Oh, man.
And one of my, there's someone I told this story to years later, and they said, "And you still married her?" But yeah, so that's the gig I didn't get to. That'd have been quite a gig.
That would have been
amazing. So, yeah.
Oh wow! So, you know, we've had Dogs in Traffic, yeah. And I'm not wanting to keep you too long, but there's some fantastic songs on that.
Some nice songs on
that. And we've had it remastered, and it's back out as well.
Yeah, one of my favourite songs on that is, can I get the title? You're Not the Only One. That is an amazing
that's
song.
A lovely song.
It's a great song, great atmosphere.
You're not the only one.
song. There's mm-hmm. a couple of good songs, songs I really like. I mean, I liked Winter.
Winter's a lovely song as well. And
but you're not the only one. There's something special about that
yeah,
song.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I bought that last week. I was in it last night from Glasgow.
Yeah, yeah.
Picked it up then, along with the poems.
I enjoyed working on that again. I remastered that, and that was fun.
The production on it's lovely.
Yeah,
it's really
I mean,
good.
It's a great. As I say, Steve Nye, he was great. You know, really good producer. And we had done some stuff here in Glasgow, and he helped finish that off as mm-hmm. well. And that was great. So it's a good record. Wasn't an easy record to make, but it's a record still proud of.
Yeah,
it's a good record. It's
one of the Scottish albums. It was, you know, it's lovely.
Some great songs. Yeah. You know, and that's the thing. I think the thing about maybe the first album, I think there's some great songs on it. I don't think it's a great record, and I think
right.
It can be, you can have a great song that isn't recorded brilliantly, or you could have a great record that isn't necessarily a great song. You know, they're two different things, and I think Dogs in the Traffic combine those. I think it's mm-hmm. some great songs, and it's a good record. You know,
and then there was some of the songs from Dogs in the Traffic that make it onto Little Death.
Well, there's that one that I remember.
Yeah, the one that you just played it.
Which I've just forgotten again.
I should have wrote that down.
I've forgotten again. That's the thing. I'll come back.
It will, aye. So some of them had an overspill on it.
Yeah, so that one, there might have been others, but again, that would be James, it would know more than I, but there was Keep Looking for the Light.
Keep Looking
so
for the Light.
So that made it.
Aye.
So we played that at the big day. It wasn't on Dogs and Trap, but it made it onto Little Death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And is that, did we get to the point, where is Love and Money at that stage? Are
splintered.
Right.
In a sense that, we didn't tour with Dogs in the Traffic, and that it wasn't the end of the band, but it was the kind of seeds of it in a sense. We did four shows
right.
For Strange Kind of Love, we toured.
Was that maybe born out of?
Well, there was a lot of things going on. I mean, James wasn't particularly well at the time, and I think he had a lot of stress doing the record and all that as well. I mean, there was a lot of kind of stress on James because he was the songwriter mm-hmm. and the singer. So, you know, all the things that were going they're difficult in the record company affected us all, but far more him than anyone else because he was the one that, you know, was a songwriter. So we didn't tour much with that, and I think, you know, if you don't tour at that kind of time, if you didn't tour a record, then what you do, you know, it's hard to promote. It's different now. You can also financially can make money from touring. Then you lost money from touring, but it was an important thing to do. So we did Dogs, we did Little Death. The record company dropped us halfway through doing that. We did that in Scotland at a studio called Sinclair that my brother-in-law owned.
Right.
We weren't related at that point, but Mark Wilson had managed Friends Again,
mm-hmm.
managed Hue and Cry, and him and this other guy, or two other guys, set up a studio. So we started recording there. I think, from memory, we got about halfway through the record when the record company pulled the plug.
Right.
And that was a financial thing. That was the accountants. They were like that. The finery were like that. We need to cut.
Right.
Some of these guys, it was a fortune. So, and, you know, we were talking about the industry earlier on. Love and Money owed the record company a lot of money. So I think the final, it was 2.5 million.
Right.
Substantial amount. But there was an advantage to owning that amount of money, and that was the fact that we owed so much they wouldn't let us go easy.
Yeah, yep.
So that allowed us to do that difficult third album, because if we hadn't owed that amount of money, they'd have just pulled the plug.
Yep.
But by Little Death, the accountants were like that, we need to get a shot of these guys, they'll never make this back. Because once they had the record, they're like, that's not going to make, you know, the news.
Right.
So that's fine. And although it was difficult, I remember me, James, Gordon, and Douglas going for a walk in the West End. You know, just like, you know, that's for James and I, that is 10 years of a record contract. In fact, longer, because it was the same contract with Friends Again. So you were looking at 12 years.
Aye.
So it's a big thing. It was a big thing for everyone. But the record company gave us money to, when they dropped us, and they didn't have to, so it was kind of
right.
And James had some money, and we invested it in putting a 16-track studio together in James's bedroom, second bedroom.
Right.
And I don't think the other guys would mind me saying it's changed days now, but at that point, I don't know if they could have changed a plug. But, so I became an engineer because I was interested. I mean, I couldn't say I could engineer, but I learned, and now obviously James and Douglas can do all that as well, but at that point I was the only one. So we got a 16 track tape and we put it in James's second
room. Is it like a new lease of life when the record company...
Well, it was interesting because we'd record in the studio, do all the drums and stuff, and we'd do a sleeve of two tracks, take that to James's. But what was interesting was I would make mistakes because, you know, I was reading about... There was no internet as well, remember? So I was reading about things in the few books you could get. I was learning things. So you were going to make mistakes. So, but some of the mistakes were really interesting. So there's a song called Don't Be Afraid of the Dark. A lot of the sounds are through me rooting things strangely.
Right.
Not doing the right thing. But I was not like that thing.
Right.
So we kept a lot of the mistakes. So we had this stuff done in the studio... And we were doing stuff ourselves. Some of it was ropey, some of it was good, and we learnt things, and, you know, we just made things up as we went. So that was a kind of new freedom. So it was difficult in one sense, but in another sense, it was opportunity that came from that. Obviously, it was a different financial situation entirely as well for us.
Did that kind of pull you away from going, I'm a wee bit, I don't want to perform anymore just now?
I don't think so. We did a couple of shows. It was just a different thing, and our lives were changing, I suppose. Before we finished the record, I had Joshua, who had already... I got married. None of our friends got married, you know. Because all our friends were musicians. No one got married. No, we were married. Everyone was like married. And then when we had a kid, I remember all the musicians coming over the house to see a kid. You know, it's just like... So I suppose that our lives were changing in that sense. And then when we get dropped, you also have that thing of, well, what am I going to do? You know, I've got two children.
Yeah.
You know, I had one child, but I was another on the way, and you're like that. So you have to, you can't live on nothing. So you have to think, what am I going to do?
Yep.
I was qualified to do nothing, you know.
Right.
I wasn't even qualified as an engineer or anything, really. The qualifications were zero. But a friend, Brian at Savar, was looking for someone to come and help at Perth College with Atari computers and Cubase.
Oh, right.
And Martin Bond at plays with Stiles, he was one of the students at the time, and I went to help out and do some of that, and that kind of got me
into teaching. A bit like what Chris was talking about in his podcast, you know, you had to find something,
you know, because money would last, but it wouldn't last forever, you know. And so production was the kind of thing for me, and I did the stuff with Media Spec for BBC, and then I opened a studio, which was a disaster, because I knew nothing about business. So I went on a wee business course and figured some of that out. And then I built studios up through the years, and that's the kind of path I took. But it was interesting doing the Little Death album, because there was elements of stress about it, but elements of fun. We did it at home. But, you know, Stuart had stopped being our business manager by that point. None of us were business orientated, and we kind of messed up and given the record to Iona. And they didn't really do anything with it.
Right.
And so I think at one point Gordon was like, I need to go and do something else. I need to go and play for other bands, make a living or whatever.
Yep.
So Gordon left, and then we kind of called it a day after that. Really.
Right. Well, everybody, that's where we're going to leave part two. I think we've covered just about everything that was to do with Love and Money there. That was fascinating for me, to sit and have the privilege to chat with Paul and talk about all the Love and Money albums, how it all came about, touring, everything, you know, and Paul to throw in the stories about Springsteen, Sinatra. Oh, I loved it. It was fantastic. So I hope you really enjoyed it as well. Love and Money were one of Scotland's finest bands. I mean, and James Grant as a songwriter is just prolific with fantastic tunes, as you will all know. So hopefully we can spread we all know Love and Money are great, but hopefully we can bring that to a younger audience, and you know, these quality songs always survive the test of time. So we're going to finish up with one of my favourite Love and Money songs, and please join me in part three of the Paul McGeachan story, where we will be discussing Paul's journey from Love and Money into the Starless Project, which is amazing. It's fascinating. So many great artists working with Paul. True testament to the guy for being such a gentleman, really, and such a talented, warm guy. He's a legend of Scotland, and that's what we're all about. So join me in part three, becoming in the next couple of weeks. Thanks very much for listening. And I'll see you soon. Thank you. Cheers. Bye.
Inflammable, I can see you with your soul in your eyes. About to catch fire, and I wanna cool you down. But why? Away from me, untouchable. I know you only see that way, but you push me to the edge and you push me back again. Closing doors and spawning dreams when I had enough of them. What the daylight scorns, the night. And I go looking for what I want in the wrong places. Unfathomable, seems that all I really ever do is wait around and keep the things that I don't really want. Don't do me no good. Inflammable.
could say that it's my hope that burns. I suppose I'll never learn, but ever since I saw your face, I've been past the point of no return, looking for a better place. What the daylight scores, the night embraces, and I go looking for what I want in the wrong places. I recognize in you a part of myself. I wanna hide inside you, but guided by you, this storm won't blow over, so we can be together, till we can be lovers. Inflammable, burn me with your love. Inflammable.